This class was recorded in June 2015 at Herbstock, Boston's homegrown herbal conference. The presenters are Rin Madura and Katya Swift, and the topic is the history of herbalism in the United States. For more information about our school and clinic, please visit our website at commonwealthherbs.com.
Let's see, are we exactly on time? Are they herbalists always are?
Oh, no, it's not even actually 2 yet. We definitely cannot start. We have to actually be late.
Maybe we can ask about what y'all's experiences, any prior knowledge you have about herbalism or history or anything in particular that y'all need to learn. I don't feel like y'all need to give individual answers, but anything you want to call out, now's the time. Can you hear us?
Yes.
If I speak like this, you can hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. That's good, because I can be way louder. Which we won't talk about at all today, but I'll just write this here.
Because anytime you say Medigon,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. This is a Welsh herbal, and I don't remember the years, but that one is really nice because it has a whole lot of folk practice mixed into it.
Yeah.
And you can see that it's not solely derived from like the Greco-Roman herbal tradition. This was really just a number of like physicians or folk healers in an area who had a solid tradition, and writing came in and they started putting stuff on paper, and that got transmitted pretty accurately. So that one's really fun to look through. I wanted to say for everybody that there's 10 pages of notes for this class, and there are a few other books that are referenced, mostly from the era of the eclectics and physiomedicalists. So this is the 18 and very early 1900s in the US. And I highlighted the ones that I thought were the most interesting, both therapeutically and also of historical value in that list as well.
I would say when we're talking about old texts, though, that one thing to always bear in mind is that in every generation, you have to go back and reevaluate every single thing that has ever been written about health and care. So those old texts may be very, very accurate, but we are different people today than the people who lived in this land were in, let's say, 1850. We are much depleted from what we as a people used to be. And so the things that they recommended may not be appropriate for the bodies that we work with today. And so it's really important to recognize that that doesn't mean the book is wrong. It just means that the situation has changed. And should the situation change again, then that book may be more accurate. But regardless, it's always really useful to see how people used to work and what types, and while you're doing that, to be thinking about, well, what types of problems were people having then, and what types of bodies did people have then, and what types of food were they eating, and how were they sleeping, and were they exposed to electricity all day, and all that kind of stuff.
So you can, Herbstock has a collection of all of the class notes that you can get. I believe there's like a password protected page on there. The password is marshmallow2015 to get that. You can also get them directly from our website if you go to commonwealthherbs.com/herbstock. Of course, we just have our notes, not everybody else here today. is awesome, so check that out. And like I said, there's 10 pages of text in like 10.5. You know, we wrote a ton of stuff in this class, and that's relevant to right now in this moment because we're going to get started, and we're not going to cover all of this in adequate detail. So what we're going to try to do is give you some broad strokes. And one of the big things we want to talk about is that history likes to repeat itself. You know, it does this in cycles. And what we're primarily concerned with today in this class here is a cycle where we see movement in the center of gravity of medicine and healthcare in a society, right? In this case, in American society or in United States, yeah, it's kind of more accurate, right? So like, where has that been? Where has it moved? How has that center of gravity shifted from time to time, right? And we see movement there between medicine as being the domain of the people as a whole, right? Folk practitioners and healers and people working with traditional medicine and that kind of thing. And how that swings over the course of the centuries over into the domain of elites of one kind or another, right? People who have power, people who have money, people who have access, whatever it might be, those being the people who start to control and own medicine in a society, right? But we see that movement go back and forth, and we see these great swings or these cycles happening, right? And so what we try to do is say, well, all right, how's this happened before? Where are we now? And what can we do to influence the course of that movement in our lifetimes and in the lifetimes of our children? All right, so that's what we're trying to get across today, and you can just let us know at the end if you think we got there. Great.
Another point that we want to try to put right at the front is that often when people talk about the history of herbalism in the United States, it's still the history of white men. Right? A lot of what we have is books written by white men of leisure, right? Not just white men, but white men of privilege, right? And so decolonizing our own history, right? We're all herbalists. We're already decolonized, I feel like, or we're working ourselves towards it. We're already who are on the fringes, and the idea that we have to decolonize our fringe, wow, this stuff is really entrenched. If even our fringe area has been taken over by white men of leisure, right, white men of privilege. So, as usual, when we talk about history, the great problem is that the white men of privilege are the ones who wrote the books. And so we are going to do our best we still need to talk about them because they were real, they happened, and those books are useful and important, but we want to present some threads through that history and some threads of, yes, there's this thread of the white men in their books, and here's this thread of the women, and here's a thread of folk traditions coming from other cultures and melting in here, being blended in, and how do we unwind this and look at it from lots of perspectives? And currently, our ability to do that is super imperfect. But we want to really make an attempt at that. I myself, having boobs, I would like to look at that from a woman's perspective and a women's history and a women's issues perspective. But there are so many angles that we can do that from. And
for those of you, sex and race and class, this is all going to get folded in here just as a matter of course, but we'll try to make it as forward as we can. Right?
For those of you who don't know, we are the co-directors of the Commonwealth Center for Holistic Herbalism, and we're also married. So writing this handout over the past few weeks has been a very interesting exercise in assertion. And he would like work on a draft, and I'd look at it and I'd say, there's too many white men in this. There's not enough witches in this. There's, you know, like whatever, he'd try again, and I'd be like, there's not enough witches. And so we're getting there. There are some witches. We're working on it.
All right, so we wanted to... Oh, yeah. We wanted to start by giving you guys something from this moment, from right now, all right? And that's the definition of medicine in the state of Massachusetts, all right? So the practice of medicine is defined state to state. It's not on a national scale. It's defined by each state's board of health and board of licensing for medical practitioners, doctors, and MDs, that kind of thing. So the definition of medicine in the state of Massachusetts is conduct, the purpose or reasonably foreseeable effect of which is to encourage the reliance of another person upon an individual's knowledge or skill in the maintenance of human health by the prevention, alleviation, or cure of disease, and involving or reasonably thought to involve an assumption of responsibility for the other person's physical or mental well-being. So we have some issues with that, right? I tried to hold my speech for you guys on the points that really matter here, but encouraging reliance on my skill is not something that I like to do for my clients, right? That's why I'm not a doctor, I'm a herbalist, you know?
Instead, I would like to encourage people to rely on themselves.
Yeah. And to build their own skill and to share skills with people so they can take care of themselves and not make them respond, like not to assume responsibility for their physical and mental well-being, because responsibility is the other face of the coin, and the other side of that is called your right, right? Your right to take care of yourself, your right to determine your own choices about how your health care is going to be conducted. And when that gets assumed by a doctor or by somebody else in a position of power, then some of that does get taken away from people. Right? We see this in the clients who come to us and they have stories about how they've been treated or things that got out of control or out of their hands. And again, a lot of that goes back to the way medicine is defined. That shapes practice, right? That shapes interactions. It shapes relationships people have with their healthcare providers.
Even your right to decide what healthy means. Right now, smoking has issues. But if depending on where you work, you may be required to give up smoking in order to get health insurance. That's happening in many places. Now, I don't think smoking is the healthiest thing on the planet, but I gotta tell you, there's a lot of things I would have people give up before smoking. And it's your right to determine what is healthy for you. That's your right. It's not up to a doctor to determine whether or not you're sane. It's not up to a doctor to determine whether or not it's okay for you to keep your gallbladder or have it removed from your body, right? That doctor can educate you on that and can tell you what's going on and can give you data and can help you make a decision that he thinks is wise or that she thinks is wise, but you have the right to a second and third and tenth opinion. You have that right. You have the right to decide, I'm going to do nothing for a couple of days. You have that right to also.
So we lead with this because we want to figure out how we got here, right? Like, how did this become the standard? How did this become the way that our culture has formalized its understanding of what medicine is and how that should be practiced, right? What's the attitude that's in place there? So let's go back in time a bit, look at the old world, and we're interested... Sorry.
We're already 11 minutes off.
We're interested both in what we could call one practice nursing and the other practice doctoring. We could say one kind is care for the ill, the other sort is like heroic intervention style of medicine, right? But the idea is that these are sort of two different practices, and that this division between them has just grown wider and wider over the years, right? But even if you look back at some of these ancient texts, you can see that that's already present today, right?
I like the words that were used for doctoring and nursing, that nursing is empirical supportive care, and doctoring is abstracted heroic intervention, right? So, and you guys know nurses versus doctors. Doctors want to come in and cut stuff out and, you know, give you the crazy pill that's going to fix all the things and whatever. And nurses are going to wash your face for you. They're gonna hold your hand if it hurts. They're also going to do amazing work that requires training and difficulty and all sorts of stuff, but in the bottom line, which one of them is going to hold your hand and wash your face? Right? That's a nurse. That's nursing care.
So when we talk about the history of medicine, people generally like to start in like Greece and Rome. You know, they start with Hippocrates, and he's the father of medicine, like the father of medicine. Okay, so yeah, right. So first of all, just as a point of interest, you know, when we talk about a lot of these ancient authors, and Hippocrates would be among them, this isn't one individual, this is a school, right? It's a it's the use of a single name was sort of a literary convention, right, throughout a long period of history where it's like, I want to put a stamp of authority upon this, and so I use this name.
It was a brand.
So knowing that first, that leaves us somewhat from the idea of like some mythic genius who solved all of these problems and came up with these principles of medicine that have lasted for eons, right? No, they were putting into practice things that people have already established, right? Through what we dismiss or revere, depending on your bias, as folk tradition, right? So Hippocrates, Galen, Dioscorides, people like that, we have names for them because they've been, again, passed down in the literature. But it's important to recognize that they were, if anything, they were formalizing or they were theorizing about medical practice that was not divined or devised by these individuals, but it was part of the culture, right? It was something that arose out of that. And even to start in Greece and Rome, that's to cut off Egypt and Mesopotamia and other societies that preceded them, and whom we do have actual historical record for them using herbs in particular ways that influenced practice in those like ancient times that we think is just where everything begins, right? So it goes back into a place where you don't have it written down anymore, but you can see how the formalized practice is always going to be an outgrowth of the grassroots, right, of the local people.
Up to the point when we started using toxic materials as medicines.
Okay.
But until that point, they were just writing down the things that were done. The things that worked best for them of the things that were available at the time. It wasn't rocket science.
Yeah. So, all right. So then, when we talk about who else was active, right? Who else was practicing? These are people that we don't have names for, right? And we can call them midwives. We can call them witches. We can call them shaman. You can pick which word makes sense in the context. But these were, again, people who were doing a lot of nursing care kind of work. They were feeding people. They were making sure that there was adequate food going on and nutritive herbs and things like that were being put into play. So this is where we get the image of the witch off on the edge of town, right? It's like, oh, why do they live next to the dark forest? Well, because that's where the medicine comes from, right? And maybe there's some monsters in there too, but that's how it goes in this world, right? You want to get some nice things that are useful to you, you also have to out for some poison mushrooms or a leopard that's going to jump out of the tree next year, right? Like, these things come together. We can't abstract ourselves away from them.
If you've ever had a relationship.
Yeah. And it's part of the function of the witch or of the shaman to be in that intermediary place and to be a mediator between the natural world or the wild world on the one hand and the human or the civilized or the square-shaped world on the other, right? And so, you know, that image, that foundational picture, is a reflection of actual practice, and I think it's very important. But there's a lot that's carried within that, right? That speaks to us about what kind of work was being done and how those interactions were taking place. You know, the idea of the village healer is somebody you go to when things get out of hand, right? And in a time when everybody was familiar with the plants that grew around them, people were familiar with medicines, right? They would know that you could grab some mint if your belly hurt, and then you could dig up some ginger roots if things were really rough, you know? But when, you also had goats to herd, and you had, you know, animals to take care of, and crops to grow, and whatever else, and so there was going to be somebody who specialized in it, right? Somebody who focused and spent more of their time on that, and had more experience.
Right? Because she'd seen all the babies, and she'd had people in the town, she'd watched them grow up, and whatever else, and she'd seen it. She'd been around. She was around the last time this flu came through 10 years ago. The last time this crazy fever came through. Everybody knew how to sit up with a kid who had a fever. Everybody knows how to do that. But somebody, some grandmother, was particularly good at it. And that was the one. It was the one on the edge, holding that space in both places.
And that's still the story today, right? Like, this still happens. This still goes on. There's still people taking care of their families. There's still people who are practicing these kind of ways. Maybe they've lost touch with some of the materials that you can use, right? Maybe they're not as familiar with the herbs, but they can be, right? That's why we're here at Herbs Talk. We're kind of our back end.
So throughout, the documentation we have is 500 to the 13th century. I suppose that those dates could be debated in some scholarly academic sort of way, but I think that there are set of posts to work with. Then at that time, the church really took over this, right? As the Christian church became stronger, and I suppose we're saying Catholic church because at least in the beginning of this, we hadn't had the Reformation yet, became stronger, medicine was about sin, right? It was about God. If you were sick, well, that must be because you sinned. And if God thinks you're worth saving, then you'll get better. And so during this time, the church strongly discouraged any practice of medicine at all. And this is when we started the witch trials, right? The witch burnings. And just in general discouragement, there was no real advancement of medicine at all during this time because the church didn't allow it. That was an affront to the church's authority. But also keeping in mind that women's medicine, nursing, care, that was medicine of the people. Doctoring was for rich people, but nursing, and even in ancient Greece, doctoring was for rich people, right? Women's work, that was medicine for all the people. And it didn't really serve the church. Just the same as today, it doesn't serve the corporations to keep all the people, all the 98% of us, healthy. It didn't serve the church to keep all those people healthy and in their good fighting weight, right? And to have them, you know, doing things like thinking for themselves and whatever else, because that would challenge the corporate authority. So it wasn't until the 1300s that medicine was legalized, I suppose is going to be, that's not really the right word, because we're not talking about quite a system of law yet, but you know, tolerated by the church. And during that time, only men were allowed to practice medicine. And they were required to do so with a priest present. They weren't allowed to practice medicine on anyone who had not first gone to confession. And the priest had to be present. The rule was that you could only treat the body. The spirit was still of the church, right? And this is part of how things disintegrated all the way down to Francis Bacon, who is like probably number one on my most hated man in history list, who actually wrote, "We must rape the earth and take her secrets from her." That's his definition of science. So when you look today at things being called science and say, how did we get this far wrong? That's how. Science was being done long before Francis Bacon came along. Anytime that there's empirical work done, you try something, you watch the result, you make a note, you try something again, that's science, right? Women have been doing that for a really long time, ever since they started cooking, right? So at that time, the only practice was through the church. And at that time, there were, of course, women practicing. And the witch trials became very, very strong at that point. And up through into the late 1700s. And interestingly, the more educated that the people became, the stronger that the witch trials became, right? The more frenzied that the witch trials became. And this was seen, or this is currently interpreted as, and I think probably accurately, as the church trying to hold on to power in an age of people becoming educated past the need for a church. Now, faith is something I think that humans, it may be an intrinsic part of human being, I don't know, but whether you have faith in the soil beneath your feet or God or your husband or whoever, that doesn't need to be legislated. You can have your faith where you want to have your faith. But anyway, so interestingly, through the 1300s, we get a lot of these accounts from the trials, and the original ones were women of affluence, right? And their conviction was based on the fact that they were healing people and they were successful. That was what was offered as evidence in their trial that convicted them, that they were successful, that it worked. So clearly, and they listed in the court accounts the medicines that were used. Right? These are not harmful plants. And they said that because they worked, it must have been the devil who did the healing. And as time progressed, then they also there started to be a conflict of interest, right? A competition between the new discipline of medical science that was being allowed by the church and the folk healers. And the new doctors, who were men, didn't like the competition. Well, if you were using mercury and bloodletting, you wouldn't love the competition either, because mercury and bloodletting don't work. We'll get to it a little later, but in fact, George Washington died because of that, right? So he had a sore throat one day, and his physician came and bled 5 pints of blood because he had a sore throat, and also administered mercury, yes.
5 pints, yeah, come on.
And George Washington died, right? So there was some competition. These doctors weren't doing so well. This dichotomy was the protection of a monopoly, right? The forming of and the protection of a monopoly.
You know, a lot of what was done there was to frame the wise woman, the witch, in a particular light, and to have an official definition or a description of what a witch was. And this thing that was established in those periods was very resilient, right? So,
who was it?
It's Ava.
Okay, so this was like a 12-year-old girl.
A friend of my daughter.
This year, who at some point had motive to say, oh, what happens is a human sells their soul to a demon and in return has magical abilities and becomes a witch. And they have a contract of when she dies, the demon gets her body to eat or whatever demons do. So this is, again, the definition of a witch according to a 12-year-old today. And it's nearly identical to what you find in the Malleus Maleficarum, right? Which is the how to find a witch and how to hunt a witch and how to try a witch book manual that was written in 1487, right?
And was in every courthouse, this book.
So this image is resilient, right? It's stuck around because it was so strongly ingrained into the cultural undermind, right? And it came in there.
Recognizing, though, that this is marketing, to me, it's actually great. I understand a monopoly. I understand business competition. And that's probably because I'm a human alive in Boston in the year 2015. But these concepts make sense to me. An entire village rising up against a bunch of women that they've lived with all their lives doesn't make much sense to me. That makes me feel very uncomfortable. And I see how you can whip a person into frenzy and, hey, I never liked her anyway. That Ellen girl, man, she's just, right? And so I can see how that could be done, but seeing in the motivation of trying to create a corporate monopoly makes it so much more understandable. And this is still happening today. If you weren't at the Fireside Forum earlier today, right? This stuff is still happening. We're gonna persecute people who threaten our business.
So, you know, the effect on, again, that idea of the center of gravity of healthcare in society, like the way that got moved by this treatment of wise women and witches and healers like that, you took this system that worked at least as well as what they had as the officially sanctioned model, right? So you took the concept of good nursing care, nourishing food, internal assistance, and you replaced that with tools and approved medicines that were inaccessible to poor people. They were inaccessible to the outcast, to the dissident, to anybody who didn't fit in with the dominant society at the time, and you said, all right, well, you can't come to confession. You're a heathen, you're a Jew, you're whatever you happen to be, right? You can't come and get healed, so best of luck to you, right? And then, of course, where did they go? They went to go and find the woman who was smart enough to still be a practitioner and to not get caught, right? So this was always there, but it was underground at the time, you know? And so you took that practice. They were driven underground, a lot of knowledge was lost, a lot of books got burned, a lot of people got burned and took all their knowledge with them, right? So a lot of things were taken away at that point. But the nice thing about herbalism is that plants keep growing back, and as long as the plants grow back, we can reconstruct herbalism. It's nice not to have to reinvent the wheel, but if you do, it's gonna be around, you know, so.
And in the end, all of us today, no matter if this is the first herbal thing you've ever done in your life, if your friend dragged you here today and you're beards, not only have now what have long flowy skirts and don't wear bras. Even if this is your first day, you know how to hold the hand of someone who's suffering. This is hard work. And so there's no way to kill this knowledge. There's no way to kill this information. You know how to take a walk and say, ooh, that's a pretty flower, and get down on your hands and knees in your belly and smell it. We all know how to do that. So they can try. They did try. They killed however many, hundreds of thousands, a million, I don't know, people, millions, plural. It's not documented. Of people calling them witches. By the way, many of them would have called themselves good Christians. Most of them would have called themselves that, right? But were burned as witches simply because they knew how to use rosemary. They knew how to,
So we dwell on this, right? Because again, we're trying to talk about these cycles, things that are going to come around and recur and recur. So if we move up over into the new world, right, if we come over to the Americas, so contact, that took place in the context of the Renaissance, the European Renaissance, right? And it was a big contributor to the development of that. And we won't dwell on it a ton, but you can't understand, it's very difficult to project for ourselves what a major shift this was in not just people's concept of the earth and everything else, but specifically to medicine, right? If we're talking about the history of medicine and herbalism here, this was like if we went to Mars, we found plants growing there that we could eat.
Or random chemicals that we could turn into pharmaceuticals that didn't exist on this planet.
If we found people there that we could talk to, if we could just restrain ourselves from killing them, you know, then we could learn a lot that way, right? And so there would be this huge shift and influence on the trajectory that medicine took as a result of that. And so in this area it was. And at the time in Europe, you know, medicine there was starting to stir a little bit. They were trying to break out of some of the religious restrictions. There were more lay healers coming into practice. As far as like herbal people we have record of, you get people like John Gerard and Nicholas Culpepper, two names you might have heard before, but these were like English authors, herbalists who were in practice, they were out there in public, they were doing their thing, and they weren't getting shut down by the church authorities at the time. So there was a little more freedom for that to take place.
Although Culpepper was taking some flack.
Yeah, well, he was really into astrology, and he had, a lot of these guys weren't very nice, you know, so that's a big problem. And certainly there would have been others too, but again, these are just a couple of names that we still have that you might have seen. So in the US, or in the Americas, right, this was a place of cultural commingling, right? Everybody talks about the melting pot, and it's got a ring of truth to it. You had lots of different kinds of people coming over, whether they would come voluntarily, whether they would come as indentured servants, or as slaves, or whatever else, you know, like lots of different new groups of humans coming in, interacting with the landscape, and then that grows a local tradition, right?
And bringing their own traditions with them, even people who came over with nothing at all, they still understood how to use the plants where they came from. And it's hard for us to understand today, because no matter how long you've been an herbalist, we still grew up in this time, in this place. And it's hard to just walk out to a plant you can't identify and just put it in your mouth. But what else was there to do? First off, these people didn't have fear of plants. They knew how to figure out which ones were poisonous and which ones were useful, right? Which ones were in relationship with us and which ones we should stay away from. They knew how to figure that out. And we can actually recover that training today, but it's difficult and it's scary because we've been told that it's dangerous. But even the people who came here with nothing, many people came here with boxes of seeds to bring their familiar plants with them, and that's how we have tons of plants that we have here. But many people came here with nothing, but you can't take away somebody's heart and somebody's brain and somebody's guts and somebody's tongue. Well, you can take away their tongue. And people could still put a plant in their mouth and say, I recognize that flavor. I recognize what that can do. I recognize that feeling in my mouth. I bet I know how to work with you. And could apply their understanding of plants in general to a new palette of plants that were familiar to them.
So we have names for some of these traditions, right? We talk about Southern folk medicine, and if you've ever heard the herbal to Phyllis Light talk that she speaks from that tradition. It's still alive today. And it was basically established as part of that cultural commingling and lots of different waves of folks moving into the American South. We can talk about the practices of curanderismo in California and the Southwest, and how that's a local tradition that included some Native American elements and also some of the elements of people who had been trained in European Greco-Roman style herbalism. Elite style physicians around that medicine had to fill that need, and it had to come in there and be available to people, and then it did.
But simultaneously, on the legislative level, right, and in the upper classes, in the general populace, there was no debate, right? If your kid is sick, there is no doctor around, or there's no hope of you affording it anyway, so you don't even bother to call in. But in the legislative environment, in the upper classes of this country already, there was a lack of awareness about antagonism between the two groups. Because even though there weren't enough doctors to make a big antagonism for the majority of the people across this country at that time, the problems were already starting to fall into place at the legislative level. And as early as 1830, they were already trying to pass laws to outlaw herbalism and other forms of medicine in this country. It didn't actually succeed until 1930, but already in 1830 they were trying to pass those laws.
Yeah.
And
so,
because of this...
So, you know, we're going to use these terms a lot as we go forward, so we'll talk about regulars and irregulars, right? And the term regular, that was something that the MD, the elite style, the university-educated physicians used for their method and their style of practice, right? Today we might call it allopathy or conventional medicine, something like that. So this was the way that they were working and the perspective they took on things. And again, the practices at the time, they were still basically using mercury and bloodletting, right? A lot of, you know, they called it calomel, it's a mercury-based preparation, it's a strong heroic purgative. They would bloodlet people whenever they had anything that looked like a fever or excess heat in the body. So that was done, and again, people were not satisfied with this. They saw that it wasn't effective for outbreaks of yellow fever or whatever else was going on.
I'm going to come and slit your wrists. I'm not satisfied with that.
You can see how somebody might kind of, you know, hope for something a little different. And so the world divided, right? Again, if you look at somebody's standard history of herbalism, you're going to see this name Samuel Thompson plastered all over everything, specifically for American herbalism. So this was a big figure. He claims to be completely uneducated, but it seems that he'd also read some Galen and some Hippocrates maybe, and he maybe had a little more going on than he liked. But he was a guy who started practicing in the 1800s. He had originally studied with a local wise woman, who apparently he didn't end up getting along with very well.
We do have her name. It was Ms. Benson. And the fact that it was Ms. Benson already says something, right? But yes, apparently she didn't put up with him for too long, a couple of years maybe, but she didn't put up with him because he had a little bit of an attitude issue.
Yeah, you know, he's a real arrogant guy. He's one of these people, if you met him today, you probably want to punch him in the face or something. Because he was just like, I will, he was very full of himself, basically, right?
He particularly loves cayenne and lobelia. Right? That was his, right?
When he was a kid. And he likes to tell the story about how he had discovered the emetic herb, the lobelia, when he was a four-year-old and he was playing with his friends, and he realized that he could get them to eat lots of this and vomit, and he would laugh at them. So, like, this is, you know, formative experience for somebody, right? But you know what? Like, between what he learned in eating herbs himself, from his father, from Ms. Benson, from another Indian doctor that he practiced with for a while, he developed the practice as a healer. He was really successful. He cured himself and his family and then some other folks. And at other times, he was like traveling to other cities when they were having outbreaks of yellow fever and teaching people his methods and doing a lot better job than the bloodletters, you know? So he's building a reputation. And he earned the dislike of those regular physicians again. And they came after him.
Because he was successful.
Yeah. Just like the witches who were successful and were then persecuted by the church, right? So this is an echo of that same pattern. See it? Okay. So this came to a head for him in 1809. He was tried of killing a guy named Ezra Lovett with using lobelia and cayenne and whatever else. Oh, he killed this man. Eventually he was acquitted. The case was basically thrown out. But what's interesting is that not too long after that, this happened here in Massachusetts, not too long after that, this state passed one of the first medical licensing laws, right? And it was basically in response to the fact that here was this healer, he was getting a lot of support, a lot of popular support, this was like the court case everybody was talking about at the time. So there was this effort again by the regular physicians and that whole group to establish dominance over the medical practice, right? That didn't last too long, actually. That law was repealed. I don't know when, but it was shortly after. So there was like medical licensing in Massachusetts, but then people gave up on it. And the reason they gave up on it was that the regulars didn't really have a lot of popular support. And a lot of the irregulars, right, the Thompsonians, as they started to call themselves, and some other practitioners, they developed a good reputation amongst the populace. And people were using those as their go-to source for healing, right? So when I say Thompsonian, Thompson, he developed a little system, and he actually patented some stuff, which, you know, he kind of had a bit of a capitalist bent. You know, he had this little, it was basically like a cross between folk herbalism and multi-level marketing, you know? And he would like have this
like
book and like, here's your stock of herbs for the year, and he would mail that out to somebody, and like, here's how to do the practice, and if you pay my patent fee, then you can call yourself a Thompsonian, and you can go and do the thing. So it's a little sketchy in the sense that he was like trying to monetize some traditional knowledge, but it kind of broke those bounds. You know, people got out there, the word spread, people started using these techniques, and then, of course, building on them, because not everybody has barberry. You can't grow kine in all parts of the country that he was mailing it off to. So people started to build their own local materia medicus. And they would still call themselves Thompsonians because they were basing their principles of practice on that kind of idea. But it expanded and it started to grow. And there were two big offshoots from that. Did you want to say some stuff? So, and again, this you might have,
when was that? Just to...
He was, so the trial for him was 1809. I don't recall when he died, but 1823. So the eclectics and the physiomedicalists are like the two big schools of thought that grew out of Thompsonian herbalism as people started to practice it more independently and started to develop it into a little more comprehensive of a system of healing. And this became, over time, the university level training, right? So there were colleges and there were schools founded and there were professional societies and medical journals for these groups and stuff. So this became, again, this was a kind of practice that was on the level of the regular MDs, right? And you would be just as likely to go see one of these herbalists as you would to go see an allopath, right? And in fact, more likely, because for a while there, this was the dominant form of medicine in our country. There were just plain more of them, and they were more popular than the allopaths. Yes?
You said eclectics and
physiomedicalists. Yeah. Long word, simple concepts, which is learn about anatomy, learn about physiology, and then use herbs instead of weird mineral poisons.
Isn't that where Post and Kellogg and the utopian movement in this country came from?
That was a parallel strain of action. So of course these weren't the only kinds of practitioners who were out there. There were homeopaths, and I'll just say homeopathy was really different back in the 1800s. They were just as likely to use a full-strength tincture as something that had been diluted. So when you read older homeopathy texts, then don't assume it's all with like, you know, 100 mg or whatever dilution. Anyway, so they were also, they had a fair amount of market share, if you want to call it that. There were Grahamists, there were like other groups of people who had their style of practice.
But always coming back in mind, these people, there were universities, right? There were small schools, there were colleges, there were universities, and they admitted women at once.
Yeah. So this was in big contrast to the regulars, who basically refused to allow women to enroll, and their tuition, of course, was always out of reach of anybody but the upper classes, the same way medical school is today, or often is.
Do you know that today, if you're over the age of 35, you can't go to medical school? Because you won't be able to pay for it. The loans that you have to take are too big for you to be able to pay for it in the number of years you still have left to practice if you start after the age of 35. So they won't take it.
That's hilarious. Anyway, so the eclectics, the physiomedicalists, their universities were open to men, women, whatever else you happen to be. And they made specific efforts that they would talk about a lot to try to keep tuition affordable so that many classes of people could come in and practice, you know. So that was, again, quite different. All of these still, you know, these were still folks with years of training. And again, for most people, especially if you go outside of the cities, it was going to be folk, right? It was going to be the witch at the edge of town. It was going to be the old grandmother who happened to have a really big garden. It was going to be that kind of thing that most people relied on day to day. So we don't want to drop that thread, right? We want to recognize that for most people, that was still the most important source for care, right? And for healing.
Also, the thing that you would call a doctor for was much different than the things that we call doctors for today, right? So I sliced my thumb with a big knife that I was cutting my knee with, and I sliced it real good. And my mom is like, oh, did you go to the emergency room? I'm like, well, I'm teaching a class on street medicine this weekend. Like, no, I didn't go to the emergency room. I took care of myself. It's not going to get infected. No, it's not going to get infected.
We have pine sap, or pine resin that we mix with oil, and some 12-year-olds made it for us.
It's totally going to be great.
Yeah, my daughter climbed a tree and got some pine resin out, and then we mixed it with olive oil, and my 12-year-old stirred it. My mom's like horrible. but that's the sort of thing that people, you know, like, that's the sort of thing that people always would have taken care of for themselves. If you needed a bone setter, you might have got a bone setter, right? I mean, that's a certain type of skill that also requires a certain type of strength. And so you'd go see a bone setter, that's fine. And if the fever got really scary, then you'd go and find Brandy, or you'd go and find whoever. But most stuff that we today would be scared of and be like, I don't know what's wrong with my body. I don't understand my body or how it works. And so I'd better go get a doctor to tell me what's happening in my body. How would you do that? They would just take care of it themselves.
So most people were doing that, right? Granny Appalachia and crossover country doctors and those kind of people were doing this work. And you know the term snake oil salesman, right? Mm-hmm. It turns out that not all of that was bullshit. Like, in fact, the original snake oil was basically an omega-3 supplement, if you really dig into it.
Or it was cannabis medicine. They had cannabis and opium and all kinds of herbs and the stuff that they were selling, so
yeah.
It actually left, so a lot of it actually worked.
Yeah, right on. Kiva Rose and Jesse Hardin have written some really good articles on that whole period, but this was like somebody with a medicine wagon, you know, an apothecarist, a medicine maker who just happened to travel around. So that was also important, and that was a key healer in somebody's life. So now we have this part where the regulars, the conventional medical people, they're trying to start to establish dominance. They're getting their footing again. The country's going through an industrial transformation, right? Things are shifting on an economic and demographic level. So we get the rise of regular medicine. The AMA, the American Medical Association, was founded in 1847, and of course from its inception, this is a professional society, it's a lobbying group, its stated intent is to improve the welfare of its constituents, which basically means to get doctors to get paid more money. And one of the big ways that they decided to do that from the beginning was to legislate the other kinds of practitioners out of the picture, right, to get them away. And they were pretty successful in that because, remember, again, this was the medicine that was used by the elite classes. It was being fed into by the people who already had money to begin with. And so, of course, that makes you able to buy political influence.
And they had two real big sponsors, Rockefeller and Carnegie. Exactly. That's what they were doing with their money at the time.
Among many other things. All right, so there was a thing that you should know about. It's called the Flexner Report. This was released in 1910. It was funded by Rockefeller. It was published by the Carnegie Foundation. This was supposedly a objective study of the quality of medical education at various universities in the country. But it was designed in such a way that it would basically force the closure of medical schools that didn't conform to the allopathic model. Right?
So the criteria for quality assessment was allopathic universities.
So, you know, the effect of this was that it closed many medical schools, like the eclectic schools, physiomedicalist universities, the other kinds of institutions, the ones that admitted women and black people and other folks. So that all happened as a result of this report, as a result of this publication. Laws went into place, licensing guidelines went into place. So this was basically just an insertion of that kind of degree of influence into the practice of medicine.
I think that it's really interesting. So the school that they used as the model for the criteria of what an acceptable medical university was Johns Hopkins.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was a new model at the time. It was based on a German style of practice, and I'm not going to get into Germany, but like it was set up as this is the ideal. This is the way to be scientific doctors, you know? And so that had a lot of power.
It's interesting to me that these are three names, Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Johns Hopkins, that I grew up being taught to respect and revere. When you heard the word Johns Hopkins, it didn't even matter what the whole rest of the sentence was. Oh, whatever it was good. Like, that meant it was the good thing, right? When you heard on PBS or NPR or the Carnegie Foundation, you're like, oh, yes, those are the good people. Those are the good ones. And it's interesting that now, looking at these things, it's like, okay, this is the past of those people. And from my own sort of, like, check here, whatever, to look back and say, oh my goodness, for most of my life, those were words that when I heard them, that was the automatic authority statement, like the stamp of goodness. And to think about, wow, okay, check your whatever, your impressions, check your assumptions, check your whatever, that at that level for me, that's something that I need to be going back and saying, is that really what I think? Is that really
You would feel this way if somebody said there was a new study conducted by Johns Hopkins University researchers which showed that kava is not in fact useful as a sedative or a relaxant or whatever else. You'd be like, wait, what? How could that be? I always thought it was. You'd stop and you'd say, wait a minute, take some kava. Yeah. Maybe it would be okay. I should not worry about it. Right? Just don't forget to do that. All right, so you know the thing to note here, though, is that the irregulars, they probably could have saved themselves. They probably had enough popular support, enough different people working in the same direction, that if they had gotten their shit together and they had stopped fighting between themselves, then maybe they could have put up a front. But they didn't do that, right? Because the eclectics didn't agree with the physiomedicalists about whether or not lobelia was safer and how you should treat somebody in the midst of a febrile crisis. Because the homeopaths disagreed with everybody about how strong the medicines needed to be in order to be effective. Because none of them could agree with that weird guy who was going on and on about these crackers he had just invented, right? So there were all these different groups, and they couldn't get along. There was all this squabbling, all this fighting between them. Question?
Do you think there was a divide and conquer going on there?
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. I mean, it's an age-old tactic, right? So, yeah.
But to me, the biggest part is that there were no women in those rooms. Even though these universities were the only ones that admitted women and black people, they weren't in the room when there were three separate conferences where the irregulars tried to pull themselves together and put up some resistance to the legislation that was being passed. And they never succeeded. But I just wonder if they brought Granny Appalachia with them, right? If you just think about the flinty Granny in your imagination, or maybe you actually had this woman and you were so fortunate to have her in your life. Imagine if the Oracle from the Matrix, right, you know? Imagine if these men had brought her and they were fighting about whose this is better and who's, what would she have done?
Y'all all shut the fuck up, because y'all right. All know what the truth is.
Right. Y'all all know how to have some cookies, right? And nobody invited the women. Would it have made a difference? I don't know. Because frankly, I think at that time, women's lib was nowhere, wasn't even being thought of yet. Well, maybe a little with the suffrage. But we didn't have authoritative place outside of the home. And survived.
So another teacher at our school, Gavin, he reviewed some of this. He had a couple of comments on this point here about our modern era. You know, he was saying, how can we learn from this era of physiomedicalism and eclectics as we face an allopathic medical institution with the financial interests in curtailing the activities of herbalists, right? That grows each year as more and more people become dissatisfied with conventional medical care.
You know, it's been 100 years.
Yeah.
It's right on, 100 years, you guys.
105, yeah. How can our modern community of herbalists not fracture along the lines of our disagreements, right? And places where I've seen a lot of this kind of talk coming out, some people like Jim McDonald and Sean Donahue trying to do this work and say, look, you know what, I disagree with people who like to put essential oils all over each other and like not dilute them and that kind of thing. I think that's kind of dangerous, but I'm not gonna shout them down. I'm not excited when the FDA goes after one of those guys. I would like them to learn better just from practice and from caring about the effects of their protocols rather than being legislated out of existence by some government authority or by somebody who says, that's not sound science, right? I would rather have us self-police these kinds of things, you know? So when you look at an herbalist here, and you're gonna find some herbalists here that you don't agree with, and if you haven't yet, then don't worry that it's gonna happen soon, right? Then try to hold a little piece of yourself that says we're all actually part of the same street fair, right? We're all part of the herbal marketplace downstairs. We're all out there trying to get people to care about plants and to put their feet on the ground and do that kind of thing. And don't get so caught up in the fact that I think, you know, telling women to use Vitex every time they have PMS is a completely idiotic strategy, right? That's fine. I still want her to be out there telling people that just for the fact that there's an herbalist. And I can change your mind about that later. That's going to be fine.
I want to just pick at one thing that you said, which was self-policing. Because the word policing means fear.
Yeah.
Right? And I know that's not where you were going with that, but sometimes we're talking and we go fast. But I would like us to be self-regulating, self-improving, all those kinds of things, self-growing, always pushing forward towards better understanding and more experimentation and being fine with saying, hey, that didn't work. You know, we've always been able to say that. It's government who says we're not allowed to say that, right? Because, oh, now I can get sued. You can get sued for making a mistake. Oh, yes, in this country you can. Well, how stupid is that, right? That you shouldn't be able to get sued just for, like, well, I tried something and it didn't work. I mean, don't kill somebody on purpose. Of course you need to. But so I don't want to think about it in terms of self-policing because that leads to taking action out of fear, right? So self-limitation because of fear. And I don't want to be in that place. I want to be in self-growth because of experimentation. Even though that experimentation may be graceless at times.
Yeah. It totally will be, you know, it has to be. So, you know, this idea of this era of persecution or in fact, legal prosecution of these kinds of healers, legislating them out of existence, that's an echo of the persecutions that came in the previous round, right? And so
first
again,
we burn them out of existence.
Right.
But
then,
now it's more civilized to just sue them out of existence.
Yeah. And this is basically exactly what happened, right? So this reduced the variety of medical practice in the US, and not just in terms of what kind of methods you use, but who were the practitioners, okay? In 1915, just as this was starting to happen, there were 7 all-black medical schools, there were 3 all-women medical schools, and those were all basically botanical-oriented institutions, right? They were practicing herbal medicine in one kind or another. By 1940, none of those were still open, and only the expensive schools that were on the allopathic curriculum, they still remained. So doctors, basically, their demographics moved, and they became, again, dominated by white men of the middle and upper classes, okay? So the other thing that happened was because this was it was intended or it was propagandized as an improvement in the state of education and the state of training of doctors, and like now we have the scientific way of training doctors, it has to be done like this, and if you don't do it that way, you're terrible, then doctors acquired this air of now you're a man of science. You have the scientific infallibility complex going on, right? Yeah, exactly. You you're remote, you're unattainable except through long and expensive study, right? And medicine is now this mystery that's not to be entered into by mere mortals, you know? And that error persists to today, right?
You can't know anything about your body. You didn't go to medical school for 6 and 8 years. What do you think you know? You don't know if you're healthy or not.
Yeah. So, and that's a big driver of problem. It's a big driver of, again, that definition of medicine that we started with and the effects that that has on the way people interact with their healthcare provider, with their doctor. And where it's, and there's actually a book on this, I forget the title, but do you know it's, I think it's like Medicine, the New World Religion or something like that?
Bill Blum?
Yeah, Bill Blum.
Yeah.
But
it's actually a French dissertation.
But it's on the similarities between the way that people interact with their physicians and the way that you interact with a religious authority, right? Where you go into the inner sanctum. Right, and you have to pass through the stages of entry to get there, right? So you get like the waiting room, you know, and then inside you like enter into the sanctum sanctorum, and then you meet with the authority, and they, you know, like do some divination rites upon you, and then they stamp you upon the head and tell you the things you're supposed to go forth and do, right? So it's a very it's structured in the same way, right? Because that's the form of authority that's been passed down in our culture, and that we
it's very patriarchal. You know, I haven't done this. 13 or 15 or 18 years, whatever. But if you've been to a doctor recently, and many of my clients have, and they come and they tell me, you know, like, how dare you think for yourself? Right? They will tell you what. And lucky, if you have a doctor who isn't like that, hold on to that one. They're not all of them. But many of them have this authoritarian complex and will treat you. And much of that is simply because that's what they were trained to do. Okay? It's not even because they're terrible people. It's because they were trained to do that. That is the system that we have. So that system and what the other part that Reed was talking about the it's getting more and more expensive. So this also is, again, this shift becoming, you know, first the shift was this way, and now it's like really breaking wide open. Medicine was never for money. When you were going to have a baby, you didn't hire somebody to catch it, right? All the women in town came over, and one of them was real good at midwifery. Okay, there's always somebody who's got a skill. But all the women came and helped you. Somebody boiled the water, and somebody brought the bandages, and somebody had to do all the parts. The women just went. It was just, oh, okay, well, Betsy's having her baby today. We're all going. That's just what you did. You didn't ask for money. When you had a baby, everybody came and took care of you. And people brought you food, and people checked in on you and the new baby and everything else. That's just what happened. There wasn't money. Until the regular doctors came in and started taking the money. And that happened, by the way, through barbers when they invented forceps. The barbers were the surgeons. And so they started delivering the babies, which isn't that weird anyway that a man would deliver a baby. Right? Like throughout most of human history, they threw the men out. Get out of here. This isn't your show. Go away. You've already done your part. Get out of here. And, or women and men were isolated somewhere, pioneers, whatever, and there was only one person to help, and that was the dad, right? But either way, there wasn't money involved. Right? Even when there was a village healer, there wasn't money involved. There may have been gifts involved. There may have been a giant gym. Where I practiced in Vermont, I lived in a town called Randolph, and lots of people were very poor. And I practiced professionally, but a lot of payment I accepted in food. Right? People would bring me a chicken. People would bring me eggs or jam or whatever, because people have food in Vermont, but they don't have money. And that was true throughout time, that medicine was at best a gift economy, not a career. And this is really the point where that became so heavily divided. This real professionalism, and professionalism is a positive word, right? Like doing a real good job, but that's not the way I mean it. I mean this professionalizingism or something like that, where this was no longer attainable. This was no longer about helping each other survive from day to day. This was about, hey,
And so there've always been those kinds of practitioners out there, you know, people in underserved communities, rural, urban, whatever it was, using tools that were around when there was no other medical care available or affordable. You use what you've got, right? So when we, a lot, again, when you hear somebody telling you the history of herbalism, they'll often say, like, well, you know, herbalists were doing their thing, there were the eclectics, the physiomedicalists, and the Flexner Report came, and herbalism got driven underground, and it died out in America during that time. And then it wasn't until 1960 or 70 that it started to get reawakened by folks like Rosemary Blackstar and Julia DeBiard-Betty and others like that. But I would say instead that, you know, that's sort of, you're kind of missing some perspective there. It's better to say that the professional level practice of herbalism as primary healthcare for middle and for upper class folks in particular, that was driven underground, yeah. And there were some things that got lost, right? There was a degree of sophistication in herbal practice that had been attained by people who were doing this full time and working in a university and a community of healers with a common perspective and, you know, writing these books in Materia Medica and revising them over the years. So, okay, that was lost or that was forgotten or that was basically what it really was. It was buried in the basement of a library in Chicago, most of these books for a long time. But there was still going to be folk practice. There always has to be, right?
And frankly, many places along, up and down the Appalachians, there still aren't enough doctors. People are still too poor for regular medical care. And so they still go to grave. And it was those grandmothers who kept these traditions not just alive, but vibrant, even throughout the time when it was illegal in this country to practice herbalism, because there was no other option.
So, but there's definitely been a resurgence in the last several decades, right?
Oh, in case you hadn't noticed.
Because you're here now, right? So that's a part of it. This is like a continuing outgrowth of that. But so in the 60s and the 70s, you know, there was flower power going on. There was research, renewed interest in folk tradition, in ecological consciousness, in earth spirituality. All those things sort of naturally led some people into using herbs as medicine, right? Medicine for the body, medicine for the spirit, like all of that got folded in together. You know, we can name some names and stuff, but the path of that was people rediscovering things for themselves or from a local tradition, like learning from your grandmother, from a local healer, something like that. And then that sort of moved over into integration of methods from other more established and more unbroken traditions. And so this is the period where people had like understood for a while that, okay, I can take ginger for cramps and I can take feverfew for a migraine, but there's gotta be some kind of system that can work for this, you know? And so for a while, people looked and they were like, well, I don't know, they've got one in India, let's try Ayurveda, or they've got one in China, let's try TCM, you know? And there are some herbalists
who
kind of
appropriate their system and put our herbs on top of it. There's that also.
And so there's some herbalists who kind of did that. But then there were others who were like, well, wait a minute, isn't there one in the Western world? Like, isn't there a traditional system like that? And so, you know, they went digging, and they were like, well, we've got Walker Keys, I guess we can start there. And, oh wait, there's this Nicholas Culpepper weirdo who keeps talking about how dandelion is a verb of Leo, and I don't know what that means, but I'll try it for a while, see what we get. And then you have people like Michael Moore, not the documentarian, but the other guy, who he spent a lot of time in that Lloyd Library in Chicago, where all of the eclectic institutions had basically sent all of their books. They were like, we have to close them up, we're going to send them to the mother school, and you can just hold them there. And so he was one of the people who dug those out and started transcribing them and putting them on the internet, getting people talking. You had people like Matt Wood, you know, doing his own research in traditional Western herbalism and writing a book of that title. So people getting interested in these ideas about energetics and constitutions and what's the tradition in our language, right, or our languages, that is where herbalism has been and where was that thread and like how recently did it get broken off and how can we wind it back and start to I'm losing my cloth metaphors here, but bring it back forward, okay? So people have been doing that. And a lot of these folks are actively writing and teaching today. And the generation after them, you know, after Paul Bergner and after Matthew Wood and Charles Garcia and folks like this, and Cascade, Anderson Geller, and people who learned from them and were taught by them, many of us have started to take that language as just this thing you teach on the first day, you know? So now, when we teach our apprenticeship program, we start out with these ideas and we say, this is where your medicines come from, right? And we refer back and we talk about folk healers and we talk about witches and we talk about the tradition of herbal medicine from Greece and Rome and all the way up through Europe and blending everything together in the Americas. And we try to tell that whole story so people know that they're not reinventing the wheel, that there have been wheels for a long time and that we need to keep rolling forward, right? We don't just stop with that. We gotta keep moving. So that's what we do now. And that's why we like that herbalism in the U.S. today is a little bit wild, a little bit unruly, right? It's a kind of a mongrel thing, or maybe another word for that is polyculture, which kind of like sounds better to a lot of us now, right? Because there's a lot of diversity, and there's a lot of change happening, and many, many different threads that are all coming together into that. So that I find inspiring, I find that relieving, you know, because it means that we're not dependent on any one authority or any one source. There's a lot of variety going on.
I think that the state of herbalism in this country today is also not just cognizant that there is disagreement and that there are different types of practice that are even sometimes contradictory. So not just awareness of that, and not just acceptance of that, but even appreciation for that. That diversity is what makes us strong. Not, we don't all have the same body, we don't all speak the same language, we all have the same definition of health or care. Some of us want lots of fussing, some of us want to be left alone when we're sick, and all sorts of different differences. And so we need to have practitioners who practice in even drastically different ways. And we probably could even say we need some doctors around, right? Like sometimes that's also necessary. We need the whole field of diversity. And I think that our current ability to appreciate that diversity and to appreciate polyculture in general is one way that we protect ourselves against the next Flexner report.
So these are the questions for where we are right now, right? It's like we've seen this cycle of conservatism and inclusion, right? And like movement from elite control to popular control and how that's been going on through history. And a lot of people here at this conference, wow, look, this is an outgrowth of people getting interested in taking care of their own health and using herbs for healing and taking health into your own hands and doing that kind of thing. And so that speaks to a movement towards inclusivity and towards popular self-care as a center of gravity for where medicine lives now. But there's also movements in the other direction, right? There's a big push towards what they like to call evidence-based medicine, right? Which is really a whitewashed term for it has to have gone through phase two clinical trials to count and that kind of thing. So there are those.
But if you paid for the phase two clinical trials and it passed because you paid for it, that's okay.
Yeah.
That still counts.
So there are those things that are present, and we try to figure out like where we are between those two currents in our society right now. It's not homogenous, right? Like, we live in Boston, it's an East Coast city, it's fairly affluent, and so this is one of the places where there's a lot of people, or there are a lot of people who are getting interested in herbalism and organic food and things like that, kind of all like putting it as part of that. So it has a particular flavor here, right? It's worth knowing. There are some fields of alternative medicine that seem to be getting more acceptance than others, like acupuncture, for instance. Even in the military, they're using that now as like pain treatments.
Of course, acupuncture doesn't really present competition to MDs. It's a different discipline. Herbalists.
Kind of, yeah, I know. So, you know, for us, we found a lot of interest, a lot of acceptance. You know, one of the things that we do at our school is we take students from the pharmacy universities here in town, Northeastern and MCP. We take their students, they come in for 6 weeks, they owe us 40 hours a week. We spend a bunch of that in class time, a bunch of that in go forth and climb a tree for me and tell me how it went, right? We give them these different kinds of projects to go through. And we try to give them a real crash course in traditional herbalism as we understand it. Traditional modern, if you want to put those words together, right? Like, we have a tradition, it's still moving, we're not stuck in the past kind of idea. So there's been a lot of good response for that.
So we've probably had 300 students come through that program, and okay. Another 100 are starting this year.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of pharmacists.
Yeah. They've been into that. Last year, the Brigham Women's Multiple Sclerosis Clinic invited Katya to come in and speak on the topic of herbalism and self-care routines for dealing with MS.
Because I have MS.
Yeah.
You would know, and that's why they had me come speak.
So, you know, locally here, also when we talk to doctors, when we talk to clients, there seems to be like a lessening of fear or scorn. But again, it's not going to be the same everywhere in this country. Mm-hmm. And we also don't want to just like assume that things are on this path of like, oh yes, they're catching on finally, everything's going to be great. Well, that's nice, and we hope it goes that way, but we have to keep watching, right?
We're definitely running out of time. But one thing I think, that's really important to say is that, you know, always follow the money. It is always, always, always about money. It was about money in the 1300s, right? It was about money when the church was calling women witches. They weren't even naked in the woods. They were just women with children who had fevers, right? So it was about money then, it was about money 100 years ago, it's about money now. And it's about trademarks, it's about the regulation of what you can call a supplement, it's about the regulation of what kinds of things you're allowed to say, and what kinds of work. You know, we're not allowed to use the word nutrition, ever. That word has been allocated to dietitians. You're not allowed to use the word nutrition ever, unless you have a license. So anytime that I write a class and I'm like, I want to talk about food, it's really hard to talk about food without using the word nutrition. Like, how do you actually do that? It's really hard. But it turns out we're not allowed to use that word, right? So more and more. And the reason that you're not allowed to use the word is dollars. It's always about dollars. Who can get the dollars? And if we can legislate, not we herbalists, but if a group can legislate themselves a niche that no one else can get into, then they can get all the dollars.
And what I would say about this is that, you know, I see this as a third cycle. You know, so we talked about church control, we talked about like medical society control, like the AMA taking dominance, but I feel like it's a little bit out of their hands right now.
Yeah.
And talking to doctors, you see a lot of these same kind of frustrations rising. It's all moved over into the hands of the HMOs and the people who handle the money for the doctors, right? So you see the frustration of conventional doctors with the limits that are imposed on their practice by HMOs and other health insurance organizations. You see the requirements of patient compliance if you want to maintain your coverage, right? You have to be treated in this way if you want me to continue to cover you, which is especially strongly applied to those using MassHealth or other public insurance programs like that, right? Which is,
so if you don't have enough money to pay for the privilege of choosing the type of services you want, right, then your services will be mandated.
Yeah. And the kind of drugs you can take and whatever else. And then there's also these elements of the...
Also, it's so interesting. So I happen to have a client who's extraordinarily affluent, and she had some problems and had decided that she was going to go back to an allopathic system to try and work on them. And it boggled my mind how fast she was able to get three different GI appointments at three totally different providers to get three totally different opinions. She was able to do all of that and be seen three different times in the span of 1 week from the time
wow.
Making the decisions to the third appointment.
Yeah, that's going to be good.
Right? That takes a lot of money to be able to make it.
money is influencing these kinds of things is on studies and trials, and how when an herb does get studied, is oriented towards the identification of patentable extraction methods, so that you can take some single active constituent and you can say, now I have this product that I can sell to you. You know, it's oriented in that way. So the money is making decisions about where our healthcare is going. And this isn't news to any of you, but just I want to bring these up, these impacts herbalism's place in that environment.
Especially because herbalism is not about the money, right? You can become a professional herbalist and you can become a full-time professional herbalist and you can still pay your bills, but you will not be rich. This is not a get-rich-quick scheme at all. It's just not. And it's never been something that you can use to support yourself. Right? The herbalists always also had their own goats and chickens and gardens and roof the thatch and everything else. Right? So we are a part of society going against the corporate model, and the corporate model doesn't like that.
And if it hasn't already been clear, like we don't dislike doctors or whoever, or pharmacists for that matter. Like a lot of our favorite students were pharmacy students, whatever. It's just that like,
we
these,
do love nurses though.
Yeah, it's just that these things have been put into place, and they shape what people believe is possible and what is necessary and what is just done. Like what how does it work? So, all right. So you know we study history so we can try not to repeat it. And again, you know, get this because there's a little more text on this part in particular here, but I just want to say a few things that you want to be thinking about. One is this question of licensure, and this debate seems to be fading away somewhat. I don't know, it comes up every now and again, but there are some folks within the herbal world who would like to be licensed in a similar way to acupuncturists or medical doctors. And generally the idea is, oh, well then we can take insurance money and then we could
be rich.
We could get there, yeah. There was this horrible phrase used by somebody who used to be in a position of some influence in the herbal community, which was that he wanted to feast at the banquet of third-party payers.
Uh-huh.
And that just kind of turned my stomach, you know. So my take on that is that licensure is a trap, you know. And this has been borne out by the experience of, for instance, naturopaths, who have found their practice model and the kinds of work that they do to be changed and restricted after they got licensure.
For that matter, it's true for MDs.
Yeah.
If you don't have friends who are doctors, say it for me, I have friends who are doctors, they are frustrated at the way that their ability to practice is also curtailed. Now, I don't love the way that doctors practice most of the time, but there are some amazing doctors out there, and they're frustrated as hell that they're not allowed to do what they actually believe is insurance companies won't allow them to. That's not what I would walk into.
Or they can't even have conversations and it's someone who's fought for medical candidates.
Right, they can't even talk about things.
They can't even, I like to have medical records that were blacked out by Harvard Vanguard because I had hour-long discussions about cannabis and herbal medicine with my doctors.
Right.
And that's not allowed to be discussed.
So this is not just our frustration, this is frustration that we share even across practices that we don't necessarily consume.
And you know, we're all for like improving the quality of herbal education, if we think we're doing our work for that. But I don't think that setting standards from some governmental authority is the way to accomplish that. Like more interference there doesn't usually seem to get education in particular to a good place. Like I'm not one of these, you know, like really libertarians who says get government out of everything. Like I'm cool with roads and stuff, but like as far as education goes, I think there have been pretty solid demonstrations that that's not the way to solve that particular problem, and that we need to take that into our own hands, right?
And in fact, there is actually a National Council of Herb Schools. It's extremely formal. We have an email list. It's called Herb Schools.
We try to herd the cats and the conferences when we're a few of us there together and say, let's see what we should do next. But
the reality is that the people who are running herb schools, big and small ones, across the country, are talking to each other and talking about, hey, how are you teaching botany? And oh, what are you guys doing for AMP? And hey, how are you handling this problem? Or hey, I just did this cool thing, right? We all should do it. And we are talking to each other about raising the bar for being seismically improved. So I don't see any particular need for intervention in terms of educational improvement. It's already happening.
So we just want to keep that going. So that's one big thing. Another thing that you might hear about, again, this comes back to herbal history, and this is a little more recent. A while back, there was an effort that was connected to the licensure thing. It was from the people who were pushing for that. There was a council, I guess, called the Traditional Medicines Congress. And it was basically...
it was an attempt for federal legislation, federal licensure of herbalists.
And it's presented today by the people who still refer to it openly, which is very few of the ones who were involved, as being oriented towards loosening restrictions on the language in the herbal industry. But in fact, it also included adding restrictions on the availability of particular plants out there in open commerce. And that would of course have to entail regulation of who was allowed to use them and who wasn't, right? So it was a push in that direction. That was the closest that we've come so far. A lot of the people responsible for that push have been moved away from positions of influence in places like the American Herbalist Guild Council and things like that. So we've seen some really promising changes in the kind of language coming from those organizations, even just in the past year. So I'm feeling pretty good about the AHG these days. I think they're pointed in the right direction, which is a nice thing to be able to say. The next thing I wanted to talk about was Health Freedom Acts, and this is basically an effort to stave off the whole issue of licensure by making it plain that safe practices like herbalism and Ayurveda and a few other things, they don't need to be regulated, right? We don't need licensure because nobody gets hurt by an herbalist, right? And I've looked, right? I looked for cases of an herbalist actually being brought to trial for harming somebody with something they gave them. And remember that Samuel Thompson thing I mentioned? That's the only one I could find. Right? Like, there are cases of people giving bad advice of the form, you don't need to go see a doctor about that, right? Or overstepping their scope of practice as an herbalist. But that's a whole different kind of problem. And so the idea of the Health Freedom Act is we can put it into the legislature that as long as you're not, doing obviously like medical practice stuff, like you're not cutting into people, you're not giving them prescription drugs, you're not doing this and that, then all you need to do is disclose to people your education, the style of practice you use, and just make it clear that you're not a doctor, which is what a good herbalist should be doing anyway. Like if you've gone to an herbalist and they don't have a little form that says, I am not a doctor, I'm an herbalist, this is my training, this is what I'm going to do for you, then they should have had one, and just poke them about that next time. So the Health Freedom Act, it would make that a more specific requirement for people who are going to be practitioners, but it also protects us from being accused of practicing medicine without a license. And so overall, I think that's a really good thing. I have some of these flyers at our table. There's a group called Health Freedom Action Massachusetts, and we're trying to get one of these laws passed here in Massachusetts. There have been 9 other states that have put one into play. We're not pioneers on this, we're just trying to get our state on board.
Rhode Island is one of them. Huh?
Yeah.
They do have this law.
Yeah.
Do you know
if this medicine is political or something? I think this is going to be a separate issue.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you can talk to me about that if you have any other questions, but we are trying to raise some money because, to get a law passed, you've got to pay for it pretty much. And so mostly it's to go to consulting fees for some people who are helping us with the legal languages. There had been a group trying to do this about 10 years back, and they're stalled out in committee because they didn't have the insider track, I guess, to kind of keep pushing it forward. So we've already gotten further than they had done before, but in order to keep it moving, or at least people spreading the word and being aware of what this is and what it entails. Again, the real short version is that it protects unlicensed practitioners like herbalists from being accused of practicing medicine without a license.
And in exchange, you disclose what your training is and that you're not a doctor.
Really very simple.
And that way, people should have the right to choose. If I want to go to a Susie and Tickle practitioner, I should be allowed to do that. That should be fine. I shouldn't believe that this person is going to cure my gallbladder.
that we do to try to prevent these sorts of problems from coming back at us again is we teach and we keep teaching. And so I urge
you. You tell your friends and you give them fireside and you make yourself in your own kitchen.
Yeah.
Or bought from Kathy Langlier at Herbal Revolution.
Probably the best of them downstairs by now, actually.
Yeah.
So it's never too early to start teaching. And if you come to a couple of classes and you can find a dandelion, then you can start telling other people about herbalism. And again, remember that we don't want to keep the practice of herbalism in some rarefied, like you have to go through a four-year training program to get at it. You start at the very beginning, and the more we can spread that, the more resilient we're going to have the foundation of folk knowledge, right? Folk tradition. So that, just like the formal practice of herbalism, that's still alive. Right, that's still evolving, and it has to be.
Even if you just are teaching people that it's okay to take care of yourself, already that's the resistance. It's okay to take care of yourself.
All right. So, remember I was saying I wanted you guys to tell us if we got there, in terms of see that big cycle in history, see how it's come around a couple times, and where we're at there now? Feel like you got that?
Are your heads bursting? Was this in group anything?
It
was. It was. Okay. We have on the website with the handouts, 10 pages, but please, if you're going, even that, we were trying to keep it as short as possible. 10 pages was the shortest we could manage. But if you come across questions, please don't hesitate to email us. It might take us a day or two to get back to you. But please feel very, very welcome to do that. Come down and talk to us at our table downstairs, to us or to many of our students who are helping us out with the table. Come every single Wednesday night, we teach something at our school, drop in from 7 to 9. So drop in from 7 to 9 on Wednesdays.
We're a few minutes over, but I think the next class doesn't start till 4. So we'll hang out for 10 minutes or so, and if you have a particular question, you can come right up.
This concludes the class. For more information about the Commonwealth Center for Holistic Herbalism, visit our website at commonwealthherbs.com.